But what I've seen CrowdStrike, what I think they made, they moved the needle is, one, Sunil's right, to give you more visibility on what's happening, but they make sense of it and it's quicker. And those malwares and viruses of yesterday are no longer really what's you're seeing impacting companies that are using CrowdStrike. The successful attacks are probably targeting the browser sessions, some sort of phishing attack.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back. Adversarial Podcast. This is really getting fun. I was looking forward to jumping in with you guys. Mario and Sunil, it's good to see you guys as always. Anything new going on in your neck of the woods? Sunil, before you take a swig of coffee, let me put you on the spot.
Well, right now for most of my team, it's high holidays, so
yeah,
it's quiet on that front, and that means I can get more work done.
All right. So you're trying to play catch up. Good luck with that.
Thanks.
And Mario.
Well, I had to deal with the traffic. All of a sudden, we got more traffic in the city. People are starting to say that we're getting traffic back pre-COVID days. It could also be that we also had a conference near my office, which appeared an AI conference, which appears to be the theme now. There's an AI conference. Goodness knows who puts it, who sponsors it. But there's one every other week, honestly.
No, I'm not surprised. Yeah. It's an AI city. It's come to San Francisco. There's an AI conference going on at all times.
AI conferences are like the picks and shovel of the AI industry, right? So
it's gold, baby. It's gold.
It's not the gold. It's the tools to pick the gold, right? You just offer the tools, and conferences seem to be like an easy way to sell the tools.
Bah humbug. It's gold. I'm just
kidding. cool. Well, good. Hey, quick, I got to ask on that, Mario, like, give us the general, like, SF pulse. Post-COVID, people are saying, oh, the traffic's back, maybe it's conference or whatever. What's the general vibe post-COVID? Do you feel like things are picking back up, labor market, so on? Has anyone come back from Austin yet?
It's really a lot. There's a lot of contradicting data because, I mean, there's still, I think California is still one of the highest unemployment in the country. Mm-hmm. And the Bay Area is not doing so well either, at least the numbers that were published. But hey, maybe those numbers are fake numbers as well, right? We don't know what those numbers mean. But in San Francisco, you could see restaurants opening up more. Restaurateurs are really excited.
Okay.
Reservations are months in advance now. Food traffic has definitely gotten more busier. Yeah. And the driving, even yesterday, my wife was commenting on how just seems the traffic's just getting busier and busier.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can tell you, like, from my students that are entering the workforce, I'm definitely hearing that the software engineering market is tougher. And I don't know how much of that is like lagging indicators of economic woe at the companies that were footing the bill, or how much of that is the leading indicators of, I mean, you got to think, even if AI doesn't disrupt the labor market the way it's promised, there's people that keep walking into boardrooms and promising it. And, you know, the directors got to be saying, like, well, hold on, then why are we going to do 500 headcount next quarter? Okay, we'll make it 400. And even if it hurts just to make good on the promises, I got to think some people are slowing down hiring in anticipation of AI.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bigger companies are probably doing that. And I've seen that, Jerry, and I speak to a lot of clients, as all of you guys do. But there's a lot of young AI companies that are hiring engineers, and it's getting competitive for engineers in that space. Sorry, Sunil.
That's so true. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I did talk to, you know, we talked about that after the Vegas and Black Hat and all of that. We talked about the competition and the Atlanta team winning that AIXCC, if I'm remembering it right, competition. And I ran into the guy who led that whole effort. And one of the most notable things he said, like, just straight up was, you know, they win, A, and the job offers, boom, just drop on the entire team, you know, like for the whole team immediately. So You're right. It's definitely still hot. And you hear about that with Meta and these crazy job offers. So maybe San Francisco is disproportionately benefiting from the micro shift within tech into AI.
Most of the Team Atlanta, I think, was Korean. So if they're trying to find a job here in the U.S., they may get deported.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. Especially if they're with Hyundai here in Georgia. That was that whole episode. But we do have an agenda, and the H-1B visa status is on the agenda, and we're not there yet. So we'll get to that, and we'll get to immigration a bit in a little bit. But to kick things off, so as usual, we collect a number of topics throughout the week, three of us and our producer, Tilson, and there's a number of things that we were talking about. But there was one that I contributed that I thought about, like, hot on the heels of our last episode. And it was, oh, there's a cat sighting from Mario. Yes, the ratings are through the roof.
Yes, we got a cat about 2 weeks ago. My younger kid finally wrote a 2-3-page proposal on why we should get a cat. It turns out a lot of kids do that.
I've heard that. I'm glad my kids have not heard about that yet.
Yeah.
No, they're going to do it. Actually, I think my kids might have done that, but we just, I balled it up and said, yeah, whatever. We're awful.
My kids are there for getting a dog, but somewhere they left out the provision around taking out the dog for a walk every night.
Yeah, it'll end poorly. I know, that's why we ignored the kids, but yeah, we'll probably get a cat one day. But anyway, so right after the last episode, I had this thought, and then I realized, oh, this would be really good to discuss on the podcast. And it was about, you know, if you go back in time as a practitioner, what are the companies that move the needle on security? And I wanted to throw it out because I feel like there's not a direct correlation between the ones that are the most successful towards, let's say, shareholder return, and necessarily the ones that have actually made a difference and improved security and lessened the amount of incidents and losses and victims. And I don't think that the layperson necessarily gets. I think they'd find that exciting, interesting, surprising in some ways. So I thought I'd throw out some names out there, and then I'd love to get your opinions too and talk about whether or not they move the needle. So let me start with one that everybody will think of. So like a CrowdStrike. I have specific opinions in, like, yes and no against it. When you guys hear that name, has the existence of CrowdStrike made the world a better place from a cyber perspective?
Well, let's define what we mean by move the needle, and I presume it's a substantial shift in how we do cybersecurity or how we look at cybersecurity.
And efficacy specifically, not just changing, but efficacy.
Well, presumably that comes with a higher degrees of efficacy. So the way I would look at CrowdStrike is that they changed, well, when they moved to the cloud model for detection, what it enabled, it was a pain from the standpoint of those who wanted to keep everything on-premise, never use the cloud, all that kind of stuff. But I think it moved the needle. I think the one thing that I would give credit for CrowdStrike in moving the needle is it brought the playing field back onto home turf instead of enemy turf, so to speak, or away. It became a home game and not an away game. What I mean by that is if an adversary wanted to find a way to bypass these endpoint protection tools, well, you have to play on CrowdStrike's turf, and everything would be observable. And so if you wanted to find an evasion technique, well, it was visible to the defenders. You couldn't try out different evasion techniques without tipping your hand, so to speak. And so this sort of model of how do we bring the advantage back over to our side by having everything be observable is what the cloud-based approach that CrowdStrike introduced, or at least made more successful, if you will. I don't know if they introduced it, but they certainly made it commercially successful. I think that changed the game for a lot of us.
I would say CrowdStrike has made a change, a big difference. And I'm going to I have to break it into Microsoft, CrowdStrike on top of Microsoft, and CrowdStrike on top of Mac. And so I need to do that because my last 10, 12 years has been predominantly in Mac shops. You know, one of the things I had at Snowflake was we're not going to have PCs. And that held true for many years until maybe the last 2 years at Snowflake. So, but anyhow, So I'm looking at it from a Mac perspective, and maybe traditionally there's been less your conventional viruses, malware on Macs than there are PCs. Maybe not. That's just my very crude observation. So take that with a grain of salt. But what I've seen CrowdStrike, what I think they moved the needle is, one, Sunil's right, to give you more visibility on what's happening, but they make sense of it, and it's quicker. And those malwares and viruses of yesterday are no longer really what you're seeing impacting companies that are using CrowdStrike. Most of them are probably using, successful attacks are probably targeting the browser sessions, some sort of phishing attack where it's not an actual malware, but something targeting the user logic, user access logic. And so that's kind of moved the needle. If you really look back 10, 15 years ago, a lot of it was, again, malware, virus, your typical thing. You open it, you double click on executable, and there you go. You got compromised. I don't think we're seeing that as much. Now, again, I got to put it with a grain of salt here. My world has been Max in the last 10, 12 years.
Well, you know, I'll introduce it by saying, like, to me, CrowdStrike is a million products, but there's two really, and there's EDR and EPP, which I don't think that's as ubiquitous a term, but endpoint protection, right? Which was a successor to antivirus. And EDR is a totally wild, crazy animal that real people don't ever deal with, but it's what they're advertising, what they sell, what they charge for, is you're going to see the adversary and be able to stop them and react and respond. And I think they move the needle on EPP, on endpoint protection. I forgot, Sunil, that you're totally right that they pushed everyone into getting over their hang-ups on cloud when it came to security tools. Because it used to be, oh, it's cloud, laugh, laugh, laugh. It's supposed to be security. How could it be cloud? And CrowdStrike finally just did the right things to win that argument and paved the way for SentinelOne and everyone else to be able to be cloud forward. Great. But that's really like an EDR story. And think that EDR hasn't moved the needle, and that's a huge statement. But for the headlines that drive us to hold a podcast and that we talk about, it's not like, oh, they didn't have the right EDR or their team was in the middle of responding and they didn't quite do the right thing. It's usually, you know, the companies who are killing execution on the endpoints aren't making the podcast, and then the ones that are getting ransomware and all these old school attacks just aren't running some kind of endpoint protection. Like, I think it killed that double click ransomware lateral movement quite effectively. And not just CrowdStrike alone, but I felt like they led the wave and that it made a difference.
Yeah, but I wouldn't put CrowdStrike as the one that moved the needle on EPP, mostly because EPP and endpoint protection and the antivirus stuff. By the time CrowdStrike came around, that was mostly a solved problem, and being
you
in
think?
The EPP space was really just to be part of that broader platform. Why do I want both EDR? Why do I want two different tools for both EPP?
But hold on, I'll argue with you about the EPP thing. Like, I mean, go back to your initial point. You were right, the notion of EPP was around, but I think CrowdStrike, and perhaps through the cloud first deployment, ubiquitized the coverage of EPP. Right before, it was like, what happened to Norton? I thought we had Norton. Yeah, but not on that. And it's expired. And I think after CrowdStrike, it was like accessible. Like everybody had a next-gen EPP.
No, I would disagree. I think Microsoft would have won that battle by saying, here's Defender.
But that was later, right? In my recollection, that was like on the heels of CrowdStrike.
I think of Carbon Black. I think of Symantec. Ooh. I think of, and Carbon Black's later after Symantec. But before CrowdStrike, I think of Cylance, for example, a company that was acquired. I forget who acquired
BlackBerry.
Cylance.
BlackBerry.
There you go. Yeah. So I don't know, Sunil. I think I'm going to be contrarian. I think maybe EPP was going down as operating systems were getting better. Their, you know, kernel protection, et cetera. But I think CrowdStrike, personally, I thought they made a big ding on that. It was better than what I used CrowdStrike Cylance and the other ones.
Yeah. So at the timing of CrowdStrike's appearance does fit along the lines of like when EDR was a needed capability. My first encounter with EDR was when I was at Booz Allen. We actually had a very early version of EDR that we called, oh my God, I don't even remember.
Tanium. Anymore. No, I'm just kidding.
No, it wasn't Tanium. It was a homegrown tool that basically did a least common
Big
occurrence
brother.
Type of least common occurrence type of analysis. It was extraordinarily effective, actually. We found tons of intrusions just using that as a basic construct. And I think EDR as a capability moved the needle. I'm not sure I can point to any one particular company that moved the needle on EDR, but one of the companies that didn't really sell a product as much as they sold a service would have been someone like Mandiant. They're the ones who actually took the practice of threat of hunting and threat detection and kicking the adversary out really to the next level. And when it comes to moving the needle, I think the release of the APT1 report in 2013, I think it was, moved the needle when it came to threat intelligence sharing, which really up until then, there was a ton of threat intelligence that was available in the national security space that the government had held. And when the APT1 report came out, a lot of folks in government who had all access to this information but felt like they couldn't share it with industry, I had the sense that they were quite relieved that there was some precedent put forth to say, hey, not only is this kind of stuff already out there that could be collected through commercial means, but it was extraordinarily valuable to industry. Mm-hmm. So let's go and start sharing more of this out there so that industry can benefit.
Yeah. I totally agree. Mandiant moved the needle. I think that one counts. And like to me, it moved the needle because most people didn't in the world, you know, I always like to talk about like the bottom of the iceberg and the majority and the long tail of data. Most people won't encounter Mandiant, hopefully. But just having it possible, having a bookend to forensics, like if things are really bad, we know we will get to the bottom of it. It's just a matter of how much we want to invest. But if we're willing to spend and willing, there are experts, they do exist, and there is some tradecraft here. And I think before, I mean, even having done investigation myself and having worked with Mandiant, it's really hard. And attribution, not just on targeting, but like post-event and the sequence of events and finding patient zero is really hard. And they've really professionalized that. And I don't think the individual, you know, getting to the bottom of Equifax and whatever it really made a difference, because by the time they came, the damage was done. But I think establishing that level of expectation and the threat intel that came out of it definitely influenced like how we do security. So I give them kudos there.
Well, you guys kind of stole my thunder. I was going to pick Mandiant next, but boy, you really both screwed me over. So I'll echo everything you guys have said about Mandiant and CrowdStrike. So I'm going to go a little bit left here and probably going to be controversial. I think Buckcrowd made a difference. And I'll tell you how
totally.
Buckcrowd is. Okay, and I'll tell you how Buckcrowd made a difference. Okay. Chris, I forget his last name, but he used to be the CISO for Dropbox. And I remember him being, as a requirement, to be a customer with them to run their business when I was at Snowflake. They required that we did some sort of crowd program. So we ended up using these guys. And I was kind of like, fine, I'll do it. But I mean, we do all these really mean stuff to our code and our environment. We hire a ton of red team people internally and externally. What the heck? But what I found was that when we expanded it, not just to include our production environment where everything's, you know, all that stuff, all the goodness of Snowflake was, and you start expanding it to other services that we use, maybe not, and certainly not directly connected to Snowflake or anything like that, but there were external services that we used to support the business. That's where we started finding some very interesting nuggets along the way. And that helped. I mean, because ultimately, maybe that doesn't get you access to production, but certainly get your name in potential headlines. So I do totally have to give back,
echo that. I mean, I think the theme we have here is like, what's the space that moved the needle and who pioneered the space? Bounties, bug crowd. Sunil?
Well, yeah, I mean, Casey Ellis is great, and he's a great friend, the founder of Bug Crowd and all. But I think to the point about that Jerry just made in terms of the space, you know, there's HackerOne, there's Bug Crowd, there's Senac, there's a whole bunch of other bug bounty, outsourced bug bounty sort of offerings out there. I think what actually moved the needle in this space overall was actually Hack the Pentagon. So the Pentagon was willing to really push the envelope here and say, hey, let's normalize this as a standard of practice. And if you recall, way back when they did that, they picked two companies to lead the charge here, and that was HackerOne and Bug Crowd. I don't know if – I think the space was just really getting its legs. But then I think what really helped drive it into light speed mode was the Hack the Pentagon. The Pentagon willing to make that a very public thing and say, hey, if the Pentagon's willing to, if the DoD is willing to do this, then hey, industry, you should do the same.
Yeah, and I can tell you, echoing Mara's experience, ran bug bounty programs, ran them early, ran them with Casey and Bug Crowd. And it was without a doubt the highest fidelity security risk identification tool we ever operated, still is for companies I work with today. And I think it's really essential. But when I go into companies that don't run bounty programs, I still run into, we've been thinking about it. What if something breaks? Oh, the lawyers think it's icky to invite people to hack us. And case studies like the Pentagon, I mean, they clearly move the needle for companies to really be willing to adopt this. So for listeners out there, if you're in that camp and you're thinking about doing bug bounty, but you're not sure and so on, just do it 100%. And if you get any guff at all about like, is this safe? Is this prudent? Let them know the adversarial podcast that it's absolutely fine.
I tell you one thing that it also made a difference was you can now put it in a scalable way. This is the key, scalable. Put it on your website. Everybody's had it mostly for years now, decades, on their website. If you see a vulnerability or something, security, please email us here. Go to this email and let us know. And typically what you ended up getting was a bunch of ruffians just bloating, spammers loading, like just sending you crap and overloading your security email. So that was always kind of challenging for us. But using these bug bunny programs, it allowed one a much more, they can get rid of those ruffians. They can ferret them out.
Good cop, bad cop, right? Bug crowd told them, no, not you.
Right, exactly. And then they could be your first line of, not defense, but your kind of
triage.
Security, right? Threats to say, is this legit or not? Does this meet the policies of the engagement that you put on your website? So they, you know, I got to give them, it made me not have to hire those people internally. Because usually you wouldn't have hired one person. You would have spread the love across your IR team and other teams within the security organization. But what it allowed us, it afforded us to focus on other things, higher, more tailored attacks, things that were more, we thought, more legit, and allow these bug bunny guys to handle the day-to-day problems.
Massive win.
Yeah, and that was a big win for us.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. You know, I had one that I probably feel more strongly about than any, okay? I think that there's one technology that has, believe it or not, curtailed cybercrime and cyber activity by at least an order of magnitude. If this wasn't around, things would be dramatically worse. And I'm giving the credit to Cisco because I did a little extra research on the history of it, but the technology is NAT. And I'll give an honorable second prize, maybe even
network
a tie.
Address translation.
NAT IP.
Network address translation. I'm getting Linksys is tied with Cisco. If we didn't have NAT and everybody that came on the internet in 1998, 99, 2000, if they didn't get a Linksys router and get NAT, then all this stupid CVEs that we pretend we care about that don't really matter on everything, the IoTs, the endpoints, listening daemons on default, on Linux, on Windows, all those would actually been exploited instead of just being academic exercises.
No,
that has saved the world.
I disagree. Jokingly. Because if NAT didn't exist, we'd be on IPv6 and you couldn't find those IP addresses.
Nah.
You couldn't scan. Half of us are on the there and don't even know yet.
So this is legit. I mean, okay. Brilliant, Jerry. I work.
And no, just to be clear, no joke. I mean,
my mom's
network didn't have NAT. I'd have to be up there all the time playing man.
I'll give you a real life example. I worked at UCSF some decades ago. And at that time, this was in the 2000s, they had a class B IPs. Freaking gazillion IPs.
Wide open on every endpoint.
And so instead of doing this NAT and making it complicated, they assign every endpoint, every laptop, every workstation with actually routable IPs, public IPs, because they had a ton of IPs. Let me tell you the security freaking headaches we had to deal with in that place at UCSF because of that. So yes, kudos to you, Jerry. That's correct. I would say NAT did make a difference.
Yeah, and the funny thing is we didn't come across it for security at all. It was just for convenience and everybody's LAN and their masquerading rules are all the same. You could just cookie cutter drop deployments. And I mean, just imagine the instructions and the support calls Linksys would have had if they were doing pass through and routing and subnet allocation, all this crap. But oh man, it saved the day all day, every day. And if anybody says, well, without it, we would have gotten better at security because we would have had to. We've tried that. That's not going to work. Hey, you know, one that we didn't mention that I thought of later on was ISS.
I thought you were going to say ISS, especially Atlanta. You from Georgia.
And Atlanta.
Yeah.
And like, they've done a lot of stuff. Well, they did a lot of stuff. But I think the one thing that was kind of the watershed for them was the scanner, right?
Well, okay, hold on. So while they created the technology, while they were one of the first commercial IDSs out there, I would argue that Marty Rush and Snort really was the one that moved the needle.
Well, hold on a minute. I'm not giving them award medal for IDS. Yes, I don't think anybody ever did anything useful in IDS. And I love Marty and I love Snort, but I'm giving them credit for Real Secure, right? The scanner, just the notion of scanning.
Yep.
I mean, you could give them a separate
both.
Blue
they
ribbon
did IDS,
for IDS.
They did host-based IDS, and they also did vulnerability.
They
scanners.
Did RASP. You can install an agent on your web server, and it'll work great. No, it won't. It'll destroy everything.
Correct.
I'm just giving them the Real Secure. Do you feel like IDS has been a successful, productive member of society?
A well-tuned one, yes.
Really? It's like, hey, warning, someone is executing this exploit pattern from 1993 against SSHD.
One.
No, they're not.
An out-of-the-box one, though. A well-tuned one, yeah, sure.
I think that's true of all security tools.
As well as a SIM, right? A well-tuned SIM is a great benefit. A poorly tuned SIM just creates a lot of noise for you.
Laugh even more.
Oh my goodness, we're going there again.
Oh, yeah, before we get off this, before we get off the award ceremony, I think we're going to have to come back to this thing in future episodes, but we didn't even talk about Cloudflare, CDN, F5, load balancers. I think those companies and categories move the needle.
What I think moves the needle for someone like Cloudflare is the ability to do security at scale. And what Matthew Prince over at Cloudflare really started to do was, one, he made Cloudflare available for anyone who wanted to use it for free. One, that's great. But two, he said, these are just built-in security services that we'll just throw in as a part of the free offering. And so it really moved the needle by making security available to those below the security poverty line, so to speak. You just now have built-in security measures that you just like literally just click on and boom, 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 boom. Like, for example, I was just checking it out there just the other day. Security headers. If you ever go to like security headers search, if you go to like the Bit sites or the security scorecards of the world, one of the grades that they give your website is based on your security headers. In the past, it used to be really hard to configure them properly. Well, go to Cloudflare, you flip on this one switch, and boom, you already get to like an A. Maybe not an A+, but you get to like an A or something.
And TLS for TLS support?
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to any organization and they fall for the ruse that that's important and you decide you're going to burn that down, the number one thing to do to fix TLS versions is actually just to move everything behind Cloudflare or CDN. And then you flip the switch later, but just moving them there is the lift.
I mean, I also think back to the vulnerability scanner, and I know we probably poo-poo on it all the time nowadays. You know, if you go back in the 2000s, early 2000s, you had things like WooFTP FTP or ISS 4.0 and 5.0 with all these scripts that were accessible through the public internet to give you access to your directory. And people were just, I don't want to say if we were being sloppier with our code, but I don't know what was going on then. Okay, I think people were just like if you go back 30, 40 years ago, people were smoking cigarettes and drunk driving like no tomorrow. And I think we kind of as a society changed. I think the vulnerability scanners have made a difference. I don't think I used ISS when I was at EY because that's what we used to do our initial scanning, but it was a pain in the ass to use. I would rather see Nessus. Nessus made it easier.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
it was much easier than
ISS. You ever use EI?
Yeah.
Retina?
Yeah.
The retina scanner?
That exactly. Thing was exactly.
Badass.
Exactly. I mean, you SMB. Go back. So anyway, so I think vulnerability scanners, as much as I look down on front upon them, they did move the needle early.
All right. Well,
So Neil's got something. Go, Sunil.
Well, the whole notion of vulnerability scanners is being able to throw stones at glass houses at scale, right? And that tells you, I live in a glass house, and maybe I should try to secure this glass house. And yes, that's helpful to some degree. Tools like Metasploit also certainly moved the needle in helping us understand what our vulnerabilities were. But I'm not sure if it moved the needle for defenders in the sense of really just fixing an actual problem, right? It's one thing to become aware of the problem. It's another thing to actually go and burn down vulnerabilities and to actually truly fix things.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll push back on that, Sunil, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, again, just discovery is one thing. I don't know if I would call that a moving the needle type of... Just being able to find vulnerabilities, any fool can find... Well, just generally speaking, it's much easier to find vulnerabilities than it is to go and fix them.
I will say, if we look back, I think there were more network exploitable vulnerabilities back then and less of them now.
There's tons of vulnerabilities out there that are yet to be discovered. What I think really moved the needle very recently, we hit upon it at the very beginning of the show. So the DARPA AI Cyber Grand Challenge, if you look at the details of it, it had two parts. One part of it was go find the vulnerability. The second part of it was go fix it.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that fixing part is the remarkable part. Hit vulnerability. The way to fix for each vulnerability, whether you want to deploy it or not, it's a different story. But just fixing the vulnerabilities is what's going to really move the needle. Just finding them, I don't think, is as much.
So this is all full circle here. So I start out by agreeing with Mario, and then I vehemently agree with Sunil as he's, you know, rebutting Mario here about vuln scanners, right? And I think generally vuln scanners cause a lot more harm than good now. And it's not because they don't fix things, it's because they create a bunch of false positives and noise and they lack context and they take highly paid important people away from the real problems. So I'll say bug bounty killed the vulnerability scanner because a bug bounty is just a vulnerability scanner done right, which is it's smarter and it's got the right vantage point. But when it comes to were there more network-based vulns back in the day, Linksys. So it's NAT again. But first, in what, 1999-ish? I looked it up. It's like 1994, and then it reached ubiquity by the end of the 90s. NAT for egress saved our ass big time. We don't even know the problems we would have had. But don't forget, fast forward, F5, the hardware load balancers, I guess Radware 2, A10, there was a whole little camp of them. And then the CDNs to a different extent. They ubiquitized inbound NAT. Because remember, in 2004, everybody was NATed going out. Everybody was using RFC 1918 addresses on the LAN. Great, going out. Your data center was full of valid IPs. And that's why they were more network-based vulnerabilities. There's the same amount. It's just you started having too many boxes. You couldn't keep up with the IP addresses. And you started overloading IPs on load balancers. And they went to farms of servers. And they started having private addresses. They still had just as many vulnerabilities. But you only open port 443 now because you it was default deny when you had NAT.
Yeah.
So NAT saved us again.
I need to give a counter argument to Sunil, because I really do this vulnerability thing. I again agree with most of what you guys are saying. However, most of the vulnerabilities that I see nowadays, you know, a local attack, some way they get on your machine and they elevate their privilege. You see that everywhere, constantly. It's just give me a break, people. Got it. Right? Now, I'm going to ask both of you this. If you're a security person and you identify a network vulnerability exploitable that's publicly accessible from the internet, you're going to tell me, and there's a patch, you can patch it. You're going to tell me that business is going to push back on that nowadays? Again, network-based attack, going to gain you freaking root level from the public internet without any credentials.
I don't think so. I think they're not. They're not going to accept that risk.
Correct.
But is that what you're driving towards? That
yes, because I think vulnerability scanners began to show us, those early vulnerability scanners, as noisy as they were, they began to show us things that were exposed to the public internet that were very easy to exploit via network. I gave you, again, Woo FTP as an example. I gave you ISS 4050 with those scripts that they had.
Yeah. But Shodan won that.
Yes, I was going to say Shodan did that. I don't think our real secure scanners did that, because we did that from internal.
Yeah.
We didn't do that. Yeah. We didn't do most of that scanning from outside, from the internet-facing side of the world.
Yeah. Shodan gets one of these awards, too.
That's right.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, cool. This was fun, guys. I mean, it's not literally an awards show, and we're certainly not trying to be exhaustive. And anybody we left out, we just haven't gotten
plenty
yet. Well, we got to talk about, there's so many, right? We got to keep on going on this, because there's ones that I want to make sure we, you know,
encryption.
Empirically
we never even
crap
talked
upon.
About encryption. My goodness.
There's
what the
other
heck?
Kudos we got to give out. And an encryption, yeah. God. Yeah, I'll just go ahead and give that one Jira right now. But moving on to what's been going on lately. So, look, there is a steady cadence of disruptive-based attacks, right? No matter what else is going on, there's always someone's offline. There was just Heathrow and a number of continental European airports were disrupted and were completely offline because there was a downstream supplier that went offline because of a cyber attack. But for a whole month of basically September, Jaguar Land Rover has had this production pause following a cyber attack. And it seems from everything I read that they pulled the plug at some point. So it's hard to tell how much true disruption there was from an adversary versus it's going to happen unless we pull the plug, so we self-inflict. It's also not clear to me, and I dug a little bit, whether this is classic, I'll call it double-click ransomware, meaning on an endpoint, it's encrypted and it's spreading laterally, versus what we've seen is screenshots that make it clear they're inside, they got root. But I don't know if they're just saying, I got all this data, and if you don't do this, then we'll share it, in which case a shutdown wouldn't really help, right? Or if it's, we can spray paint all the cars pink because we control the robots. What are the signals you're getting out of the limited data that's coming out here? And do you think they're just overly conservative and shutting things down really quickly? Or do you think this is like a watershed, serious, deep-rooted attack?
I think the Occam's razor would suggest that it is a preventative measure similar to what we saw with Colonial Pipeline. So their IT systems got popped. They don't know if their OT systems are also affected. And so as a precaution, they shut things down until they have a clear confirmation that there isn't any compromise of your OT systems. That would be the most logical, in my view, guess as to what's happening and why the production systems have gone down or paused. And there's no specific, hey, we've been ransomed or rather, the OT systems are now ransomware and inoperable.
It's crazy. I mean, if you think about the number of companies that get ransomware and pay the ransom, at that point, nothing has changed on the calculus you just mentioned. We don't know if they have access to the OT system. They probably do. They seem to have had root. Yet just because they wrote them a check, they feel comfortable continuing on business. Right? I mean, nothing has changed at all. If anything, it's even worse. You have no idea what they did. You just gave them the ransom, but you still know they were in there. So, I mean, it seems like a pretty conservative decision, though, to go a month here with things shut down. I mean, I saw something about employees being told not to come in as of September 1st, and that hasn't changed yet. I mean, will this just go? I guess we'll never get to the bottom of it, but are people just being way too conservative in their reaction? And they need to
not necessarily.
Take some
rest? So, the one general question that, one way to look at this is, they're getting an opportunity to exercise their business continuity plans. And very few people have an opportunity to truly test out complete black start procedures. So if, let's assume that there wasn't an actual attack, but they had to do a full black start, like from beginning start procedure, how long would that take? Would it actually take potentially a month if they've never exercised that before? And I would argue that there are many companies in this exact same boat where just knowing exactly how to get every system back up and running again is not a trivial exercise, and it just takes weeks for one to figure that out.
So if this turns out to be destructive, wet ransomware that took all the systems down, they had to do a full rebuild, then it is what it is. If it turns out that they were worried that that might happen and therefore they took everything offline, do you think it's possible that'll turn out to be a bad move here? They overdid it.
Free BCP exercise?
It's not free. They're charging. They're paying like what was it, $50 million a day? It's insane.
Hey, at least it didn't have to pay for consultants to do it, right?
Yeah, that might have been more.
The first thing that when this article, you guys mentioned this article, I thought, well, boy, I guess the Jaguar and Land Rover has lost its panache in China and in Russia because they're allowing these guys to go and hack it. Right? Because they wouldn't do that maybe 2 years, 3 years ago, right?
Well, hey, speaking of the BCP exercises, Sunil, something that was on my mind recently. A lot of people, when you get a certain level of maturity in a big program, you have these commitments you make to doing exercises. Right, and the minute you say, you don't have a policy, that's your audit thing. Next year you come back, we got a policy. What does it say? Well, we're going to do an exercise every quarter. Year after that, oh, you didn't do an exercise this quarter, you get dinged again. So you kind of regret it. But when you put these in there, like just my tip for everybody who's in that boat, doing any exercise, if you must, don't do it if you don't have to, but if you must commit to exercising, explicitly state that an actual live fire exercise satisfies the requirement. Right. We had a lockdown at our kid's school, I don't know, 2 weeks ago. Unfortunately, it turned out to not be a big deal. So that's great. Everything's fine. Yesterday, lockdown drill. I'd argue they already had a satisfactory lockdown drill.
You know, that is a really important point, Jerry, what you said, that, you know, you should put it in your contract. If people are mandating a BCP be performed annually, doing what you just recommended is gold. And we did that as well. I think on the BCP, I hate it. That's another one I hate. It's doing BCPs annually for some companies. Really, like, you know, especially if you're a cloud company. I think a lot of it, it just feels like, oh, are you kidding me? What do you want me to replicate? How do you want me to kill AWS? You want me to shut off one AWS region and put it in the other region?
But we did.
Yeah, we did.
So if BCP is the human side and DR is the systems, right? Then I would say, and have said, that with BCP saying that live exercise qualifies, that, oh, let's check the logs. Oh, yeah, some people worked remotely yesterday. Boom, BCP exercised.
And you're right, but I put DR and BCP because everybody messes those anyway when they're asking us to do it annually.
Yeah. And by the way, Sunil, back to the Jaguar Land Rover thing. It wasn't a BCP exercise because they didn't continuity the business. It was a massive absence of business continuity.
Sure.
It's more DR, disaster recovery. 30 days. It was recovering from a disaster.
It's DCP, it's disaster continuity. And that's the problem. Hey, so since our last episode, man, the CVE of the decade, maybe? God, that'll be a fun show if we actually tried to the CVEs that move the needle. But actually, this one is great. It's kind of a good story because as far as we know right now, it wasn't exploited.
No. Okay, so mm-hmm. first of all, for the listeners, we're talking about the massive intra-ID problem where I forget the researcher's name. Anyway, he's a well-known researcher, but he discovered the one key that rules them all, so to speak, for the entire, for everything in Azure. And Jerry was about to say, well, as far as we know, nothing, well, it wasn't compromised, but that's actually part of the problem, which is there were no logs associated with the use of this, with these tokens. And so Microsoft says, hey, we don't really know if, there's no evidence of this being exploited in the wild, but that's because they don't have any evidence. Like, they literally don't have evidence. There's no logs associated with the use of these tokens. It's only if you make changes do you actually see residual artifacts of that. But if there were no changes and it was just purely read-only of whatever's in your Azure tenant, there's zero evidence of that.
And statistically, what are the chances that this one individual limited resource security researcher found something that none of the national intelligence agencies ever found? Probably not great, huh?
Well, so you can't prove a negative, right? And that is one of the big challenges that we have in security. And there's a common exercise that we do perform, which is when we see this type of event, the question that will come about is, were we affected? And the answer, we of course want to have a definitive yes or no, but in this case, it's a, we don't know. We don't know if we're affected. So what does that mean? We hope, of course, that it was only this one researcher that discovered it and nobody else. But it could mean, for example, any secrets that were in anybody's environment could have been exposed. If I wanted to remain stealthy, I would just use whatever I discovered at a time of my own choosing. And you wouldn't know how I got that token or how I got access to your environment.
And Sunil, maybe for audiences, I'm sure people have read it, but can you give us a TLDR again? What this is? What is it? This one token to rule them all?
Well, so actually part of what I'm really struggling to understand is how Microsoft allowed this to even exist without logging. So what are the patterns or anti-patterns that enabled this to exist without any sort of way to know that it's being used or abused? So essentially, what was discovered was this one token or set of tokens that basically granted access to any Azure tenant, regardless of who owned it. And it essentially is a master key. It's a master key that allowed you to touch any tenant within, anyone's tenant within the Microsoft ecosystem. I think there was some specific belief that the government, the GCC side of the equation, wouldn't have been affected, at least not in terms of this particular token, but if they were using the same architecture, then the GCC environment would also have been exposed in a similar way with a master token that could be used to hit any tenant.
From the vantage point of another GCC tenant.
That's right. Yeah, within the GCC environment, you would be able to access other GCC tenants if the same vulnerability existed there as well.
And was this accessible to only Azure internal? It was developed for Azure break glass. This is like a break glass account. When all stuff hits the proverbial fan, this is the one account that can still get you in if something that we were broken. Is that kind of what I'm kind of insinuating here? Why it existed?
I don't know what the use case was for Microsoft to have this there.
As a cloud provider, I'm telling you, that's one thing we usually leave one token to break glass in the event something. It's never like somebody intentionally did it for malicious intent or even were.
So granted, right. A break glass use case is a legitimate use case. And so what I was trying to think through, as I was hinting at earlier, is when we have such patterns that may be necessary for operational purposes, you would also expect that pattern to also say, when you break glass, let's make sure people know you broke that glass,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
There's a sound, yeah. there's residual things on the floor. Except in this particular case, when someone used this token, it was completely invisible.
I got it. So let me tell you what I think happened. Because they did not collect the read access. Let's say you just logged in. You didn't make any changes. You're just accessing something with this token, so you don't see it. The problem was they couldn't rotate it easily because they did not know what it was accessing or what it had access to. So they were concerned that it might break something. I mean, Microsoft hadn't known about this. I think what happened for them was they did not know what the impact would be to rotate, because to rotate a token, it's not that hard, guys. It shouldn't have been this hard. But I think to your point, Sunil, because you could not see the events, the logs of that token being used anywhere, you didn't know how impactful it could be if you changed the token. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt here.
Well, I think all this brings up a really interesting point. And so about the, if you have no logs, we don't know. So one of the lectures I do is about, I do two lectures in a row that are about incident response. And the first one I define like a taxonomy for incidents, like severity levels and that sort of thing. And the next one, which I just did yesterday, I walk through, 2 days ago, I walk through up to 9, depending on when we run out of time, sample incidents, which happen to be completely real incidents from my past, but I don't have to disclose that there. And as I go through them, you know, stop and ask the students, like, what would the severity be here? What would you have to, what would change that? You know, what extra info might become apparent? And there's two in there that are really similar to this. And it brings up a philosophical discussion that the students started asking about. That's not a clear answer. And they're about, in the absence of logs, should you assume the worst or should you assume benevolence? And the two examples that I use are, one is, guys, so we had a red team. We did M&A, closed the deal. Part of our M&A playbook was have a red team hit it as soon as it's closed. Did that. Hey, we got all of AD, right? And we did it from an external vantage point. Here's this kill chain. We were able to go in there. But by the way, while we were on this Windows joined web host, we found a tarball on there or a zip file, whatever it was. And it was 7 years old, and it contained all of an AD dump. And it was in a web directory, right? That's a classic thing, right? You crack RC on a web server, you get whatever data you get, you put it in one of the directories of the web server, and then you could download it. So, you know, the kind of legal mindset is, well, let's look through logs and see if who or whatever ever accessed this file, partly to see like adversaries' attribution and so on. But if you have complete logs and no one ever accessed it, then oh, it's okay that someone broke in and created a tarball, right? Of course. No logs, not back to 7 years, probably not even back to 7 days, real life. So you just don't know whether they really downloaded it. That's exhibit A. I think there you could pretty safely assume that they downloaded it after they created it. Maybe you just feel differently, meaning if you have disclosure requirements around a breach that they kick in. B is you get an email from Sunil, I bet you remember his name, the security researcher who decided to brute force iterate every dictionary attack against S3 bucket names. And then as he found them, he found a bunch that were unprotected and started tweeting about them all.
Yeah.
You get an email from that guy or tweet that says, hey, there's this S3 bucket, has no ACLs on it, it's wide open.
Yeah.
And, oh, that's awful. And then you start thinking, well, did anybody else guess this name? Did they find it in the past? You look at logs for access. Of course, there's no logs. And in that one, I'd lean more towards, no, this security researcher was the first one to come across this. I'm not saying that's conclusive. That's not my decision to make, bring in the lawyers and so on. Do you have a overarching or do you have a rule of thumb of in the absence of logs and data, whether you raise the alarm and call the lawyers and start talking about notification requirements versus you say, nah, it's good?
At the end of the day, that's also a risk management decision. Right. It's not a risk management decision in the context of notification. It's a risk management decision of, do we assume compromise
And do we, for example, rotate credentials, do we take action as if we were compromised? Or do we do we monitor for certain things that would suggest a compromise has occurred, and therefore we need to go and rotate things? Going back to the earlier point about moving the needle, like one of the folks that I would have said moved the needle was Harold Fink's The Canary, which is exactly for these types of situations. We don't know if we've been compromised, but we have canaries littered around such that if you happen to use one, well, we now know we got compromised, right?
Yes.
And that sort of indication is super strong signal. So I think we have a situation where if you haven't been proactive in doing something like that, then you are left in the dark and you're going to have to make that hard decision. And more than likely, most people aren't going to do anything, okay? But if you feel like you have to do something, but one additional safety measure, this would be something like a canary would have been one of those safety measures.
But it's hard to go back in time, eh?
Yeah. And by the way, just I want to clarify something. I was describing this as a master key, but it's not just a single key. So in the sense of, Mario, your point about rotating keys and such, that's not exactly what the nature of this particular issue was. The issue was that Microsoft had these impersonation tokens that you could use and that are commonly used, but the problem was that these impersonation tokens weren't being properly validated. And so you could basically use these impersonation tokens, which are used for legitimate purposes, but weren't being, or could be abused for exactly the situation that we see here.
But for customers of Azure and or for Azure engineers internally, do you know? I don't know enough about the details. That's why.
I'm not sure if I answered the question.
Yeah, public, external, right? That would be able to exploit this.
But initially, so like I'm wondering initially if it was meant for support for Azure engineers to support the client.
No. It's a part of these impersonation tokens are used for some backend service that Microsoft has. And once you have one of these tokens that you can create from your own tenant, then you can then use that to authenticate into other people's tenants because the authentication wasn't being done properly. The validation of that.
So it wasn't the token itself, is that it was allowed to cross boundaries between customers. Oh, yeah, that's wicked. That's really wicked. That's pretty wicked.
But my point is that the use of these impersonation tokens, I mean, the fact that you're impersonating should suggest a couple things, right? But the perspective of if there's any critical service that you have, I don't know what decisions were made by Microsoft to not capture this. I suspect that it's a common decision that we sometimes make, which is logs can be expensive, okay? And maybe in this particular case, for whatever reason, they chose not to, they thought it was too expensive. And maybe, I don't know. I'm only speculating here. But if at any point in time we think that there's a critical function that's happening, as a good practice, we just have to, we in security have to say, hey, we have to have some kind of logging on that type of function.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to connect. I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to connect it to Jerry's question about whether you see this you see this file that's been available, but you can't tell if anybody's accessed it or not because you don't have the logs collecting it. I tell you, and I hope I was representing what Jerry said correctly. So
yeah.
What I've seen is, and I think we all experienced it, people are using blob storage for everything, which is great. God bless them. Awesome. We need them. Okay. But it's great. But like something like S3, if you leave that in the public internet and you're putting files out there for your customers, for anybody else, you know, marketing material, whatever, to Sunil's point, the log, I mean, this we had to make a risk assessment, a risk decision on that. But the logs would generate millions and millions of dollars. I'm not bullpucking you. Just read only from the public internet would be millions of dollars worth of logs on S3. So That is not advisable, folks. I know it sounds like every security person, what the hell are you saying? You're not capturing logs. Well, you're saying, well, right. But you're saying, well, okay, fine. What I'm going to monitor and capture logs is anything that writes to it. So I want to make sure that only the people that can publish are coming from an internal source within your company that's trusted, and you monitor the you log that activity. You say, Mario's team added that file. Okay, great. As long as that continues to be the case, you have a relatively control of saying, I know where that file came from. At least you're collecting those logs. And you enforce a policy, and there's ways of doing this, not just by policy, not documentation, but actual technical, that you don't allow production data or anything like that to be exported into those S3. So you only do marketing material. And you say, fine, I'm not going to worry. As long as it gets uploaded from the right place, an acceptable place that we have reviewed, and the kind of data that's getting uploaded, if it's just marketing material everyone's going to access, I'm just going to put it on the public internet, and I'm going to let it not log access from the public internet. Does that make sense for Reed?
I think that's conditional logging, I'll call it. Let's say conditional access.
Correct.
Like,
correct.
If you know
correct.
This thing's always okay, correct. Stop talking about it.
But to Sunil's point, it gets really, I think that's what Sunil was saying, it gets really expensive.
Oh, yeah. And what you don't want to do is A, log it all, B, agree when the lawyer suggests that that's a record of the company and needs to be subject to 7-year retention period, right? And C, asserted in an audit that's going to test you to make sure you still have the logs if they're not doing anything. But before we move off that one topic, one thing I think you guys would enjoy is when we get into like, how do you make a decision in the absence of logs and whether or not you need to cry foul or not? And I think we've all been in situations like that. Joe Sullivan, I think he would, you know, preach on this, that the answer is you don't have to make that decision and you certainly don't have to do it in a vacuum. Get the brass in the room. Give them all the facts and let the GC and the CFO argue this one and outside counsel and everything else. And doing that, the more you increase the audience, the more it's going to bias it towards, oh, there's accountability here, so we're going to err on the side of disclosure. But SSCSO, D&O insurance, all that stuff, most important thing you can do to stay out of the woods is just to impregnate the rest of the senior management staff with these types of problems.
Yeah, syndicate the risk decisions.
Syndicate the exposure, that's right. All right. This has been a fun one, guys. Hey, one thing that is on our docket, I think we can make it through this last topic here, is the H-1B imbroglio. I know for me, I saw, God, you know, I think the most frustrating thing about the current, like, governance cycle, if you will, is administration cycle is the media and the vector in which information comes out, like proclamations coming via tweet and stuff like that is just so, feels so unofficial. So I think it was on a Friday, if I remember right, that this news dropped. And then there was this great 24, 36-hour period where there was a lot of ambiguity and confusion and people rushing back into the country and killing travel plans and on about H-1B visas having a $100,000 fee on it. For a while, people were starting to make pronouncements about how this was going to work and that it's going to be $100,000 per year and every year. And that was just fabricated. Turns out to be a one-time application thing. And then everybody just assumed it was for existing H-1B holders at first, too. And then it was clarified it would be for new ones starting in 26, I think. So it went from, maybe this is even strategic. If so, it's brilliant. It went from the end of the world to, oh, okay, it's only things that would have been the end of the world if they were the only news to begin with. But I think we're uniquely positioned to talk about the impact on cybersecurity and team makeup and the people that we've worked with and whether or not this is going to be impactful and change the direction of employment in the cybersecurity industry. Do you think the H-1B plan and handicapping it this hardcore is going to have an impact on it?
Okay, so let me state a couple things just so folks know where I stand. I'm very much pro-immigration because I myself am an immigrant, and I think immigrants bring a lot of value to the economy and to us as a country. With that said, H-1Bs specifically were meant to service a certain type of need. The need being we can't find qualified people in the U.S. population, citizenry, you know, citizen and permanent resident population, and thus we need to bring folks from outside the country to fill some of these roles.
the question here is, are we in the same situation? Are we in this situation as it pertains to cybersecurity today? Okay. Do we need to hire people from outside the country to fill cybersecurity specific needs? I would make an argument that the answer is no.
Hmm.
And the basis of that argument is somewhat based on this notion of what does the cybersecurity market look like now? And Jerry, you probably have a view on this because you teach cybersecurity at Georgia Tech, right? And you have students that graduate. And the question is, are they able to find a job right away? Or are they stuck in being able to find a job? And if they're stuck in being able to find a job, it's because are there not enough jobs or are they not qualified? If they're not qualified, then you can argue that H-1B might fill that need. Mm. But I will tell you, when I used to work at a certain bank, we hired a lot of H-1B people that were just out of college or just out of graduate school, right? And so it's not like they had any more qualifications. By the way, they were actually extraordinarily qualified from a technical standpoint. I mean, my goodness, the education they got was incredible. But at the same time, what do we need to fill these roles? And I would argue that for cybersecurity specifically, I would question the need for H-1Bs to fill the gap that we have today.
Well, I just go ahead, Jerry.
I think that there's an algorithmic answer to it, and that's that there is a correct price. I think a fee is the right thing to make people put their money where their mouth is and like, I can't find anyone here. Okay, it's going to cost more. Is it worth it? Nah, then maybe you could find them. Is it worth it? Yeah, it is worth it. Okay, then I believe you. Think as silly as that says, with like, I think I saw data on this and the median being somewhere in the $150,000 range and the salaries in the tech industry on the H-1Bs. My common sense would have said that too, 125 to 150. In that, I think the correct handicap, if you will, would have been like 25 to 33, something like that. And then people, we'd still have a good bit of H-1Bs, but it would come with a, are you sure you really didn't find anyone? And I think at 100, it pretty much says, don't even do it. Like, if you can't find anyone at all, then outsource it or, ironically, offshore to Tata or whatever it's going to be. I think the number's wrong. I do think culturally it's become so normalized that like we've lost sight of the purpose of this. And anyone who's worked a while has seen like the little flyer in the back of the break room that says, computer engineer being paid $125,000. If there's any Americans that could do this, apply here now because we're about to hire someone that's not. And it's just been like insincere and just kind of shoveled away. But it's people are just used to it. And I can tell you, like, student-wise, I would argue that a lot of the students who've come in from abroad to study here have done so to get a toehold in the States and to start their job prospects. And they will end up going down. They would have ended up going down the H-1B route and been exactly what you just talked about, Sunil. And that's got to dry up substantially for this.
Yeah.
So I haven't heard this discussed. This is just me, you know, rusing that I could see your applications to higher education taking a huge haircut as a result of this, for better or worse. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Mario, what do you feel about this?
Well, just to double up on what Sunil said about immigrants, I'm an immigrant, so I'm going to quote Hamilton, the musical, immigrants, we get the job done. So H-1B visas, right? Like you guys worked at larger companies. I mostly have done startups and eventually, you know, one got bigger, but most of my world has been startups. And so for us, H-1B visas were a pain in the ass. They're costly. You got to go through a process. Yeah, if you have the HR department, you put those posters, blah, 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 job opportunity, whatever. But if you're a startup and you don't have a name recognition, it's hard to find competitive, talented people. Okay? And then I'm also going to break it up a little bit. And this is such an overgeneralization. I'm going to get dinged by both of you. So bring it. Where we use H-1B visa folks, where it's not in the traditional developer place. Like if you're developing a product, so this is what you're selling to the industry. That's not where I saw H-1B visas folks use. Rather, it was in the enterprise, the IT organizations that needed some Salesforce administrator or some Workday administrator. Some stuff, folks, honestly, that Jerry, Sunil, I struggle to find any student in engineering at school that was getting a degree wanting to do administration of Workday or Salesforce administration after they get out. So what you do is you say, well, I don't have that. And so I can't attract them. Who wants an engineer that, or an engineer, put yourself in an engineer who's gone to Cal or Stanford or big name or whatever, and you paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for your education, come out of college to go and become an administrator to Salesforce. You're not really doing a lot of coding. I know there's Apex code, whatever, but that's not a lot of coding per se. So it's not the most sexiest job you want to get. So it's hard to find talent and find experienced talent to administer these business applications.
Use the word experience.
Yeah.
But I use the word experience, but I would argue an H-1B candidate wouldn't be experienced in managing Workday either, right?
No, that's interesting. You say, okay, well, wait a minute. Am I missing something here? Are you saying that? Oh, give me a little bit of flavor on that. I want to hear that.
Well, I mean, okay, and this is my experience.
Yeah.
Your mileage may vary, right? First of all, most of our H-1B candidates did go into development jobs.
For you, in your experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. It's the same here, but I'd also say most of our technology workforce was software engineering. So therefore, it carried it.
Did they do back-end administration of things like SharePoint and Workday? Only if they didn't do those. Eventually, maybe if they didn't do so well as a development, we wanted to keep them or something, then they may
SharePoint
migrate to those type of jobs. But certainly, they didn't have that type of skill coming in, right? And if I actually wanted to hire somebody to do that and I didn't find somebody experienced, then I would just basically hire somebody from the U.S. just out of college and say, hey, go here, do this, okay? And usually as an intern, and they build up the competency to do it as a full-time employee. I don't know of an IIT program that says, here, let me help you specialize in managing Workday, right? It's not a degree that'll come out of a...
Yeah, but there's a lot... Okay, so I get your point, but there's a lot of people that what I was exposed with had that experience in their respective countries because their respective countries focus on that and supporting enterprise applications. Just to name a obvious one, India, for example, maybe even Argentina, maybe Singapore, I don't know. But a lot of them were doing that in their home, in their original homes. We maybe hired them remotely, whatever, but they were already in America and they already had that experience. And that's what we were looking for. And by the way, it wasn't less money. We're paying comparable money here in the States for anybody. I mean, so it wasn't 100,000. I mean, we're talking north of 150,000 easily for these jobs. So it's not like they were not good jobs, good paying jobs. We just couldn't find talent, local talent in the Bay Area.
And I think, like, to me, the hiring patterns, the cultural hiring patterns and the ethnic hiring patterns in major enterprises are, to me, have been viral. Like, people hire the communities they run in when it comes to word of mouth. It's, you know, other people that they know already and that they associate with. And so, like, I would say, like, if you wanted more diversity in your team, then you need to start by having hiring managers who are diverse. And then it becomes viral and things just are self-serving there. And I think where we got off the rails a little bit on H-1B and lost the mission, if you will, it went from we can't find a U.S. citizen, so let's go and expand the search now after a certain period. It went to, I know this guy, and thanks to the H-1B program, he can get in. And the search has started there. It's not like it went there after a period expired. And I mean, on paper, that's what we were asserting to was that we had run through the search and we posted this thing on the corkboard in the back of the refrigerator for a whole 3 days, we swear. But, and so in that regard, it's not in fulfillment of the mission. I think it would be equally viable to change the mission of it and you know, say that's not what we meant to do with this. But for the way it's stated and what it's supposed to be, than putting some kind of additional, and there is an overhead, like, you know, Mario was pointing to, there already is an overhead to sponsoring an employee, but this makes it very tactical and very measurable. When you mentioned Mario, when I think it's something like 60% of the CS students at Georgia Tech are from India specifically. So like it's objective, the data, and you know, you didn't just throw India out of there out of the blue. Like we definitely see a lot more representation out of India. And then in a feeble attempt to try to not be biased, you threw out Singapore. I'm glad you did, because that reminded me. I was like, I've never heard anybody from Singapore even
feeble
leave the city.
Feeble attempt. Come on, man. Sure is,
like, there sure is, I'm not flying over here to get an H1B. Like, man, there must be like two people.
I had to
people.
Throw something out there.
But it's funny because it's really interesting because I worked in Singapore. I had teams in Singapore for a long time. And Singapore, it's interesting. If there's a spectrum to draw here, I like to do that a lot, right? Where on one hand you have this of like, we're going to penalize you for going offshore. On the other hand, what Singapore did was they incentivized you and would pay some of salary. I think it was a third of salary for the first 3 years or something like that, if you would hire a Singapore permanent resident.
Wow.
And they've been running that for, I guess, about 5 years now in cyber in particular. I mean, there's a few, you know, disciplines, but specifically cybersecurity, because they wanted to commit to that. And it was impactful enough financially that we really pushed in that. And it was hard. It was hard to find PRs, right? The majority of the folks over there were from neighboring countries, from Malaysia and
China.
Indonesia, if not
so
China.
So you said China, right? China. You mentioned China before.
A lot of Malay and a lot of Indonesians as well. With massive salary disparities, by the way. It was like for PRs versus people that, you know, came from 6 miles away. In any event, so they were actually paid. It did exactly what you would think, which was to drive up the base salaries of everyone. Because, you know, oh, well, we're going to get recompense here. Oh, does that mean we can pay more? No. Oh, they're asking for more. Are there any other PRs? No. Okay, let's raise the salary. So just drove up salaries everywhere.
Let me ask you a question before we, like, just to put a bow on this stuff. We notice a drop on H-1B visas hiring for us during the COVID times. And we were able to go remotely. We were able to hire people remotely. We were able to hire people in Alabama. We were able to hire people in Ohio. Mm. And so, again, for us, it was not just the Bay Area. It opened up. The Bay Area is freaking uber weird. I'll admit that. It's very competitive, okay, for talent, for good talent. And I think, I don't know if it was you, Jerry, or Sunil who said something about, but what I'm trying to highlight here is once COVID came and we were working remotely, we were able to tap into other markets in the country.
Domestic markets, yeah.
Domestic market. And there were, you know, U.S. citizens or legal residents. And so our H-1B visa dropped. That's or it could be that people were sick and they couldn't fly from
people weren't
countries.
Flying. They weren't traveling.
Right. And maybe that's what it was. Yeah. I mean, what do you guys think?
I think, like, look, remote's gotten a bad name at times for totally different reasons and nothing to do with that. But you're right, it does enable people to go into different parts of the United States. But what I think, like, if you meet halfway between remote first and enclaving and doing H-1Bs, I think the middle ground is what we're seeing is hubs, right? I mean, we're seeing it all the time. All the big companies, all the Fortune 500, not literally. Now they're saying, like, you need to work in one of Atlanta, Dallas, you know, Nashville, right? These kind of more affordable cities. And so that's probably kind of like doing what you're talking about, Mario, but without just quite opening the floodgates and remote. You got to be within 60 minutes of Huntsville, whatever it is. You hear it all the time. All right, guys. Well, I'm glad we touched on that topic. That was a fun one for sure. And I knew you guys would have some good insights on it. But we ran a little bit long today. This was great. We got tons of stuff, and I can't wait to the next one already. I think we've got 4 or 5 different topics that didn't make the cut this time that are going to be fun for next time, and maybe we'll get back to a little more of the award ceremony as well. But thanks, guys. I hope you guys have a great weekend, and I look forward to the next one already.